may also say that there's a relatively extensive bibliography on our website on the event page for this for today's event. If you'd like to explore some of the things that that he mentioned, and also websites, journal articles, books, etc. So we invite you to go visit that as well. So we have a good amount of time for conversation, as always, and the floor is yours. We just ask that you introduce yourself before you speak. Yes.
Anna Marie Murphy from Boston College Magazine. What is non-establishment Judaism like?
All right. Well, I mentioned this idea of particularism as a civil religion, and one of the people who formulated this notion of the civil religion, besides Jacob Neusner, who I mentioned, is a Jewish educator named Jonathan Wucher. And in his book, he talks about the fact that in the post-war years, it's more or less the golden age of American Judaism, Jews became very much convinced of the necessity to build institutions. Judaism has never been all that much an institutional religion, in part because conditions of diaspora meant that you never knew how long you were going to be in any one place. You didn't invest, for example, synagogues. We're nowhere near as cathedral-like as Catholic churches. And your Catholics knew they were going to be there. They built these great monuments, these cathedrals, and huge churches. Jews were much more likely to see themselves as always threatened, and therefore they couldn't invest that much in physical space and in physical institutions. And one of the things that Wucher argues is during the height of American particularism, Jews created institutions not unlike Catholic institutions. Bigger synagogues, more, you know, impressive, great architects, and that the structure of Jewish life took on an establishment somewhat like the diocese and archdiocese of Catholicism. Big organizations, hugely funded, wealthy contributors, and so on. And so you developed a kind of Jewish trinity, that you would have the synagogue, the establishment, and so I forget what the third one was, but you know that there would be this this huge investment. This is not what younger Jews are interested in. They are much less likely to make one, if they go to synagogue, and a lot of them don't, they're much less likely to make one synagogue their home. In fact, there's been a almost perfect example of answer to your question of what is non-establishment Judaism. It's enormously popular, minyans, prayer groups, that deliberately take place completely outside of synagogues, that are voluntary, people just get together and they pray and they read and they discuss and so on. That's non-establishment Judaism. And it's enormously appealing. There are increasingly a number of younger Jews who are beginning to accumulate wealth, and they're not necessarily donating that money to the Jewish established organizations the way older Jews habitually did. So,
that's not established. Yeah. Hi, my name is Yael. I'm the graduate research assistant here at the Boise Center and political science department PhD candidate. When you talk about, thank you for this presentation, I really enjoyed it. When you talk about this outlook of universalism, can you explain what it will mean to be Jewish with that outlook?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tough question. I was bar mitzvahed, so probably, as I say in the book, the only other times I've ever been to synagogue since then are to speak in one. I'm a totally non-observant. My children do not have a Jewish mother. There are a lot of Jews that are not religious, but nonetheless are strongly ethnically identified. I'm not one of them. To some degree, I guess I am. I know the names of all the Jewish baseball players and that kind of thing. I always shock my friends by having to know who's Jewish and who isn't.
There are Jewish baseball players?
In 2004, there were four Jews on the Boston Red Sox out of 25.
And the Armenians?
I mean, probably. One of them, Craig Breslau, is still pitching for the Boston Red Sox. Craig Breslau is a Yale graduate from a Jewish background who was admitted to medical school and chose to become a professional baseball player instead. But my point is that despite all that, I still feel Jewish. And I can't really identify all that precisely what it is, because it's not really religious and it's not really ethnic. I think that I'm proud of my Jewish background because of this universalism. That it's a... Isaac Deutscher, who was a biographer of Leon Trotsky, wrote extensively about non-Jewish Jews. That was the famous essay he wrote called Non-Jewish Jews. And he talked about Sigmund Freud, and he talked about Emma Goldman, and he talked about all these people. And he essentially said that what was Jewish about them was that they were dissenters, they were marginal to their society. That's the kind of tradition that, you know, I sort of identify with. So, I don't know, what was your question? What does it mean for...
What is the content? I mean, is there something universal about how all of those who fall under the umbrella of Jews can be understood as Jewish, or is it some sort of combination of history, ethnicity, religious faith?
Yeah. It's some kind of combination, and it's not especially well-defined, I guess, for me, and I'm not sure much would be gained by trying to define it more precisely. It's a zeitgeist. Nice Jewish term.
Yeah.
I'm Pamela Brenner from the Finance Department. Could you talk about what elements in the young people are preventing them from identifying Judaism? What are those impediments?
Well, I think a lot of young people are identifying with Judaism.
But you mentioned that there are young people who are different from that generation of the 90s or the 50s, 60s. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh, I see, with like organized. Well, the non-establishment?
Yeah. The non-establishment Jews, those young people who are not contributing to Jewish organizations.
Yeah, well, we're talking generalizations here, but for younger generations, they've grown up in a much more multicultural society. Things like viewing homosexuality as a sin just don't resonate at all, even among people who would view themselves as politically conservative. In this generalization I'm making, the more traditional forms of Judaism would not be appealing. And of course, there are lots of young Jews who are ultra-Orthodox. There are even young Jews who have converted, in a sense, to ultra-Orthodox. Shabbat, the major organization for ultra-Orthodox outreach, is all over the world trying to recruit younger people. And in a way, that, of course, is very different from ultra-Orthodox Judaism in the past. It's much more outgoing, it's much more warm, and so on. So I don't know. I think it's people who've simply grown up in a world where Jews have been generally accepted, where anti-Semitism has significantly declined. I mean, the Anti-Defamation League has a hard time finding anti-Semitism in the United States these days. It really has to stretch to do it. I just think the world looks entirely differently. I don't think I'm answering your question.
Can I ask
in the way,
in what sense do you think that the conflict with the Palestinians or the Israeli treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank situation, et cetera, is a factor in alienating potentially interested
people? I think that, after the 1967 war, there was just this incredible feeling of triumphalism in the American Jewish community. What an astonishing event that was. And it was almost immediately followed by the campaign to save Soviet Jewry, which gave American Jews another huge organizational vehicle. I'm sort of fascinated by the campaign to save Soviet Jewry because it was a humanitarian effort that was highly particularist at the same time. In other words, we're going to save human beings, but we're going to save Jewish human beings. Those two events, I think, the 1967 war and the campaign, really were enormously appealing. Young people, these were events of my lifetime. I knew all kinds of people my age who didn't have any feelings about Israel at all, and in 1967 suddenly turned themselves into Zionists. It's that mood that really doesn't attract anymore, and of course a good part of it is, a fairly articulated critique of Zionism, but it doesn't even have to be a fairly articulated critique of Zionism. I think there's just a general unease among a lot of younger Jews who may not be up on exactly, how extensive the occupied territories are and may not be able to identify precisely what it is, but what I'm trying to say, I guess, is that 1967, at the height of this particularism, support for Israel was totally spontaneous, widespread, almost unreflective, and it's just not that way at all anymore.
We have two more questions on the table here, and then Eve. Okay, so go ahead.
David Northrup, formerly of the BC History Department.
David and I went to Israel together.
And that's what prompts me to ask a difficult question, because we listen to lots of points of view in Israel and Palestine and the debates about a one-state and a two-state solution. The corollary of the title of your talk, at least, that it's good for Jews to be a minority, would seem to suggest the one-state solution would be the salvation of Israel in the long run once Jews cease to be the majority.
I'm going to have to change. I hadn't even thought about that. It's a provisional. I'm going to have to change it. I meant minority here.
Here. Okay. Well, that's a clear enough answer.
I'm still a hopelessly two-stater. I think two-state solution is the only one that is really compatible with universalism as I understand it. Now, we could have a long discussion about that, but I'm trying to write a book about the diaspora, not a book about Israel.
I'm Eve Spangler. I'm in the sociology department, and I wanted to pick up on Pamela's question. I'm not at all a scholar of religious participation, but I think the sort of non-establishment younger Jews who have a very weak and creative definition of their identity, is that not also quite parallel to Catholics and Protestants in America?
Oh, yeah.
So it's not only determined by the specifics of Jewish history.
No.
I mean, there's other forces at work.
No, it's very much like, Eric mentioned in the introduction that I wrote this book called The Transformation of American Religion, and that's one of the themes, how at least in the United States, all religions lose their sort of hardcore particular. So, yes, I think it's very much. Now, does the specifics of Jewish history give it a particular coloration or shape? Probably, and so on. But it's very much part of this. I think in a lot of ways, Jews are, particularism sort of suggests that Jews should turn and build a fortress around themselves to protect themselves against the non-Jewish world. But all Judaism at all times is influenced by the non-Jewish world. It's just really been a fact of life. And I think some smarter scholars, even some very, very religiously, I guess I didn't mention in my talk, but more or less the first part of the title, The Blessings of Exile, comes from a talk that was given by in Brookline, Massachusetts, in 1956 by a man named Gerson Cohen, who was about to become the president of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, where he served. And, of course, that's the heart of establishment Judaism. If you were to sort of identify the current president of the Jewish Theological Seminary as one of my buddies from high school. I went to a very Jewish house. It really is at the heart. And the conservative Jews, capital C, Gerson Cohen was the first to call for the ordination of women. But he was as much part of the Jewish establishment as you could. And to a graduating class at the Jewish seminary in Boston, which in Brookline then, I'm not sure if it's those, he gave a talk called The Blessings of Assimilation. Mm-hmm. And one of his points was Jews always assimilate. The idea, and he gave all of these examples from Spain to Vilna. And it's just an amazingly impressive talk. And I'm amazed that at that time, such a prominent Jewish leader could have said positive things about assimilation. Mm-hmm. It could have quickly disappeared thereafter.
Yes.
So there are all ways you could approach this topic, and you're mainly looking at the intellectuals and the way in which they're conceptualizing this. So as an anthropologist, I also try to look at these questions from the grassroots and look at the ways in which individuals, particularly young people, don't want to pay congregation building fees. They don't want to be under the authority of a rabbi. They want, and they find that minyanim, if they want to be Jewish, are a good way to do that. So that's one group sort of looking at that. The ways in which people seek community to be parts of communities of trust, which is a very great challenge in American society. But the second issue are these universal values that are all around us. The issues of human rights, of environmental sustainability, of social and economic equity, of universal tolerance for all. And the question that people face is, are Jews face, are they going to pursue these values through secular organizations? Are they going to pursue these values through an increasing number of very well-organized Jewish organizations, mm-hmm. such as American Jewish World Service, I think is a very good example of that. So I just wonder to what extent you're considering these kinds of community and institutional factors.
Well, I think the more interesting are those who want to be self-identified as Jews, want to learn everything they can about Jewish history and Jewish theology, and want to be universalist. And there are a number of such people. And I could give lots of examples. I'll just give one because I was just visiting them 2 weeks ago. There's an organization in Stockholm, of all places. Now, Stockholm is not a place you would associate with Jews, although there are more Jews living in Sweden now than there were before the Holocaust. Maybe the only country in Europe where that's true. But this organization, Paideia, Greek and not Hebrew, was formed by an Israeli, although she was actually born in Madison, Wisconsin, named Barbara Lerner Spector. And when her husband, they both lived in Israel most of their lives, but when her husband was offered to be the rabbi in Stockholm, she went along and she created an organization for what she calls unexpected Jews. These are all those people, primarily from Eastern Europe, who had Jewish origins and Jewish roots, but never knew about it until the collapse of communism. And this organization sponsors one-year fellowships for people to learn Hebrew and to learn about as much about Jewish. All they do is read Jewish texts and interpret them. And it's a thoroughly universalistic, thoroughly committed to human rights. I mean, after all, it's people who lived under a totalitarian society. So there are ways, I think, in which one can be particularistic and universalistic at the same time.
We have a few other questions on the table. One, and then Obrita, and then here. Okay?
Hi, Askin, but I'm from Lesbos.
You're going to ask me a question in Armenian.
And you know the question.
What about the Armenians? No, I deal a little bit, you know, after all, I'm here in Boston. I'm fascinated by the Armenians. I actually been to Armenia, and actually when I was there, I met the Catholicos, the Armenian Pope. But the Armenians have a diaspora. They also have a state. They're also have a huge experience with being a minority, and of course they also faced genocide, and they intermarry. They intermarry at much greater rates than Jews are. I mean, Jews are worried about intermarriage. They should think about Armenians. If you're a 20-year-old Armenian now, and you're going to get married, I think the chance of you marrying another Armenian is so much lower than the chance of a Jew marrying another Jew at this point in the dance. But as far as I know, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, when Orthodox rabbis say that the assimilation in the diaspora is worse than Hitler and the Holocaust, do Armenians say that intermarriage among Armenians is worse than Turkish genocide? I mean, I just couldn't imagine.
No, they blessed the Turkish genocide for bringing us here. My father used to say, thank God, not for the genocide, but for the Turks, because we got here.
You're exactly right. I mean, Kevin Kenny, who teaches in our history department and has just written a book about diaspora, I asked him, is there anything similar in the Irish diaspora to the idea that you're somehow inauthentic or selling your people out unless you live in Ireland? And he said exactly what you said, that the Irish diaspora is kind of, you know, welcome. I mean, the Indian diaspora is the second largest in the world. The Chinese is the first. And as far as I know, Indians in India are proud that Indians in England win the Booker Prize and that Indians in Canada dominate Canadian literature. I don't know of any other diaspora that had built into it what the Zionists call the negation of the diaspora, the idea that only if you live in Israel can you be an authentic Jew. It was part of Zionism. It was expressed by Israel's national poet, Chaim Nathan Bialik. It was expressed by Ben-Gurion. It's even expressed today by some of Israel's leading intellectuals and writers. I don't know of any other people. And I'll be hopefully be corrected. I wish there were other people, but, you know. Anyway,
yeah, we've got two other questions at the end of the table.
Urvida Mostafai, Romance Language and Literatures. Thank you very much. This was a really interesting talk. And I'm very interested in your book. And I was wondering, to what extent are you using the dimensions of art, the artistic and intellectual dimension of this question, which is very rich? And, of course, you know, among the numerous references that come to mind, I'm thinking about Kafka,
mm-hmm.
who wrote about
yeah.
minority
right.
and minority language and literature. And so I was wondering to what extent is your book...
I do talk a little bit, but more contemporary. When I talk about the difference between the Golden Age establishment Judaism and the current non-establishment, I have a fairly long section about the fact that the novelists of the Jewish Golden Age, Saul Bellow and
mm-hmm.
Cynthia Ozick and Philip Roth, all wrote about specific Jewish communities. They grew up in entirely Jewish neighborhoods. Bellow grew up first in Montreal, then in Chicago. And he evokes this dense world. Alfred Kazin grew up in Brownsville, evokes this world. They all evoke this world. It's concrete. It's based on a real space and time. The greatest younger Jewish novelist, I'm thinking of Michael Shabon's Yiddish Policeman's Union, invent a reality, an entirely imaginary reality. Or Dara Horn, a wonderful novelist, has written an entirely magical realist book about Jews during the Civil War. None of it... I mean, so within Jewish literature, you see this transformation from one generation's rootedness to another generation's much more universalistic kind of thing. Well, who did this? the town in which Chagall grew up, which is in White Russia, hosted a conference last year of this organization called Limud, which is one of these younger non-establishment things. And they hosted it in his town. Chaim Soutine, another great Jewish artist, was from the same town. But so was Menachem Begin, and so was Yitzhak Shamir. They all came from the same warm place. So again, I think you can sort of find similar kinds of things. You're, of course, interested in France, and there's a French universalist who I think was one of the most important universalists the Jewish tradition ever produced. His name was Richard Marion Strauss. I don't know if you know him. He was Polish-born. He became France's leading Shakespeare scholar. He started a circle universalistic Judaism. Now, of course, in France, we have Finkelkraut and the others. Henri Lévy and someone who are much more particularistic. But France is one country, I think, in Europe where the dominant mood among intellectuals is much more particularistic than anywhere else.
Yes?
Hi, I'm Jillian Maxey. I'm a PhD candidate in theology.
Right.
And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are. You've talked about civil particularism and universalism, and as a scholar of comparative theology and theology of religions, I tend to use language more of theological exclusivism and theological pluralism. I'm just wondering what you see as the relationship between those four or among those four terms within a Jewish spectrum.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that what I've described about particularism and universalism would apply to other religions. You're the scholar of comparative religions, not me. I don't know what they would be called. I mean, there's obviously a very, very conservative form of Catholicism and a very much more liberal form of Catholicism. I don't know if people use the term. In class yesterday, one of my students is here, I did use words like exclusion and inclusion really part of these differences in outlook. And I'd be perfectly comfortable with those terms. And it wouldn't surprise me at all to learn that in other religions there are very, very similar tensions between those two things. All right.
Yeah.
Anything else?
We have a couple more minutes if you'd like.
Question.
Don't be shy.
I have a question. How does your son...
You're not going to ask it in Armenian?
How does your son feel about your position? Is he in agreement? Does he feel differently?
I have two sons.
You referred to the fact that you married somebody who wasn't
right,
Jewish.
I have a daughter and two sons.
Okay, how do they feel about it?
Their mother's not Jewish. She's probably even more, I'd describe her as anti-religious. I'm sort of more, you know, I tend to be sympathetic to religious people without being religious myself. So the three children grew up with no religion whatsoever. None.
I guess that wasn't my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
How do they feel about, no, but how of being Jewish. Are they Jewish? Are they not Jewish?
Yeah, well, I was sort of getting to that.
Oh, okay.
But, so, you know, in Judaism, everything turns on what happens when you're 13. And since for the two boys, bar mitzvahing them was out of the question, the only question was, would they get invited to the bar mitzvahs of others? And they didn't.
No?
They didn't. One. I have two sons. You know, I'd say for both of them, who were 6 years apart, there was only one bar mitzvah invitation to the older one and zero to the younger one. And I just simply assume that word had spread that kids know these things in a place like Brooklyn High School.
How did they feel about that?
I would imagine it was pretty meaningful to them. And we talked about it. And, you know, they said, they take what comes. But, my guess is that they would be universalists at heart. Now, with my daughter, it's somewhat different because we agreed, my ex-wife and I, that when we had children, the girls would be given her last name and the boys would be given mine. So she has a totally non-Jewish name. And she also was blessed with her mother's blonde hair and blue eyes. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that anybody ever knew or even associated. But the boys are very different. They look Jewish. You'll forgive the expression. Wolf is an unusual name. It could sort of go either way. There's a professional football player named Wolf who's African-American. You know, it could sort of... The original name, as far as I know, was Volovich, and could have been Americanized as Walkowitz or Wolfowitz, believe it or not. I'm glad it wasn't.
Anna Marie, you had a question?
Well, I just wondered if you'd ever read a book called Mona in the Promised Land by Jen, about a young Chinese American who wishes she was Jewish and actually tries to convert because... I think for the reasons that you describe your pull to Judaism, she loved the voice, the ability of immigrant Jews to defend themselves with their voices. Anyway, it seems
the book, as I recall, takes place in Scarsdale, which is and Gish is a friend of mine. She actually wrote a blurb for one of my earlier books. I think you're exactly right about what you're saying. About that, but that does remind me of a big story that took over the New York Times Magazine a few years ago, and it involved a professor at Harvard Law School, whose name is Noah Feldman, and he married a Korean woman, and she converted to Judaism, and his synagogue wouldn't accept her. You know, religiously speaking, she was Jewish, but she was Korean. So they left the synagogue, and there was a big article in the New York Times Magazine about this. I think they're no longer married. As I think. But that's...
Andrew?
Andrew Prevo in theology. I come from an African-American tradition, but also identify as Creole because there's so much mixture.
Mm-hmm.
And I was intrigued by your point about how you identify, but you're not really sure what makes you Jewish.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if the category of memory plays a significant role there as something that connects you to a tradition, even if you're in a more universalistic mode of it.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's been written about extensively about the role memory plays in Judaism, that exilic people need memory because it's the only thing they have. And so there's a very famous book named, the Hebrew word for memory escapes me at the moment, but it uses the Hebrew word for memory as its title, about this, about how memory becomes central thing for an exotic people.
What is the word?
It'd be Zahar.
Zahar
means memory.
Yeah, right, that's right. That's the word. Thank you.
Zahar.
Zahar. The book is called Zahar. And also the name of the author's name is
Yerushalmi.
That's right, Yerushalmi. Thank you. The book is very helpful. About being mixed, I didn't mention this in the talk, but there's been at least two careful ethnographic studies of mixed marriages and what happens to the spouses and what happens to the Jews. And conversion is not that common when a Jew marries a non-Jew. Generally speaking, both traditions are taught to the children. So, you know, for the argument that intermarriage will result in the death of the Jewish people, there's a counter-argument that intermarriage expands what Sergio de la Palla, who's Israel's leading demographer, calls the expanded Jewish population. That is more and more opportunities to reach out to people. And but essentially what it comes down to is that it's up to what people do. And one of the, I think one of the most fascinating findings from one of these books is that even though a Jew marries a non-Jew, and the non-Jew doesn't convert to Judaism, and the Jew doesn't, that the Jewish person's Judaism deepens when married to a non-Jew. That's an unexpected
thing. Deepens the what?
When married, when a Jew marries a non-Jew, their Jewish identity deepens. Which is an interesting thing. When you think about it, I guess it makes a certain amount of sense, but I sort of found it an unexpected thing.
Any last questions before we wrap up? Well, this is, yeah. Yes.
No.
Well,
it's been fabulous.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much.